What are we? Who made us? And why do we love our children so much? Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. Today we're going over a comic rather than a book, Jupiter's Legacy and Jupiter's Circle and Jupiter's Legacy, the Netflix series, if you've seen it. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Will.
Hey guys, how's it going?
So, let's just start this by talking about a little bit about Mark Millar and Frank Quitely. And for Jupiter's Circle, it's Mark Millar and Wilfredo Torres. And automatically there's something to say about Mark Millar because he always gives co-creator credit to his artists, you know, giving credit where credit is due. So as a big comic nerd myself, got to give him props for that. If you don't know Mark Millar, he's also written Kick-Ass, Kingsman, Wolverine, Old Man Logan. What are some other ones?
Civil War.
Marvel Civil War. Superman Red Sun. I think that's a couple good ones. And Frank Quitely, I just know as the guy who drew one of my all-time favorite comics, my favorite Superman book, All-Star Superman. So I'm all about this one. I'm rip-roaring and ready to go.
Whereas me, on the other hand, I'm not a huge fan of comic books. I've always had a small comic collection, and I've never really engaged with them as much. I was more into like the novels. I understood that, and I didn't understand, you know, the value and the way comics are experienced, like the gutters, as you were mentioning before we started recording. Like I didn't have the ability to do that. And then I think I got into anime and manga and naturally progressed into this world where you're being able to go right to the source and get the writer and the artist who have made the story that 8 years later is finally getting to Netflix, when like you could just save yourself so much time and find so many amazing stories and get captivated and spirited away by art and ink on a page. It's incredible.
Yeah, and if we're going to start off by talking about like Netflix as a goal, like that was never really Mark Millar's like intentions either. Like I've watched a couple interviews with him, and like the way he talks about the comic industry, it warms my heart. Like he literally talks about people coming to him saying like, we want to make all of these, you know, these productions with you. We want to make these television series. And he's just like, give me a year. I need to make some comics. Like that's where my passion's at. That's what I love. And it's just like, yes. Like he knows the medium that he shines in. And if I have to give my personal opinion, I have to say the books outshine the Netflix adaptations in every case.
I think it's apples to oranges for me, and you know I like them both, and
yeah, but like
and
when,
completely it's a completely different experience.
Yeah, but like when we got into this, it was, you know, I saw Jupiter's Legacy on Netflix and I was like, I don't know, maybe I'll check it out, maybe I won't. And then Will came up to me and said, hey, I checked out this Netflix series, have you yet? I'm like, maybe I'll check out the book if it's good. And I'm like, oh, it's Mark Millar. Oh, it's Frank Quitely. I'll read the first chapter. If it's good, I'll start the series. The next day, I'd read all of Jupiter's Legacy, starting the series.
It pulls you in. And I think when I got into the series, like my wife found it and she was like, I'm watching this show. It's about superheroes and they live by this code. And one of the heroes breaks the code in the first episode and it seems really interesting. Maybe you'd be into it. And I checked it out. I was like, this is fascinating. I love this. This is great. Let's keep going. And then, you know, I told you about it, as you said, and you went off and you just did your comic nerd thing and you consumed the written word first. And I finished the series and then you finished the comics and then you started the series and then you said, we got to talk about this. And I was like, okay, I'll read the comics. And I started the comics and I couldn't put them down. And it was like, I don't like the comics more than the Netflix series because I started with the Netflix series and I like we're reading the Lord of the Rings, you know. I like the amount of time it takes to explore the universe and see all of the minute to minute, second to second interactions that make up an hour long episode, whereas the comic books, like we can't even talk about what happens in the first volume of the first comic because everything happens and it happens so fast and you still have this full experience of the world, but you're zoomed out and you're going through arcs of plot and development and life and death in the blink of an eye.
And like I was talking about before we were recording, most of the story happens in between the gutters. You only get snapshots, and Mark Millar is just one of those masterful writers that can put together a comic that just doesn't let your eye go where he doesn't want it to go, and he doesn't let your mind wander where, it's not supposed to. He keeps you into the story, and it's so fast paced you don't even notice some of like the obvious things that are like right in front of you. Like especially in the more in the Jupiter's Circle comic, that kind of happens when it's going through the backstories. It's like, oh, there's a lot of sneaky things going on here that you don't catch on to until the shoe drops and you're like, oh, okay, that all makes sense now. So
Yeah, that's exactly it. And you said that at one point when I was reading the comics, you're like, just wait till you get to the end, it'll all tie together. It's like, yeah, but you're all over the map and you're like completely caught up and you don't really know what's going on and you love it and you put it down and then it all comes together. And it's really intelligent and clever and interesting. And I think with like the Netflix series, you know, you can take this frame that's snapshot and you can turn it on. And you can actually pan it around, and you're not limited to the box. And I think one of the good comparisons for that, and why Netflix can do universe immersion so much better than a comic book, is you look at the egg scene with George, and they've got him at like an 8-foot-long table with 30 eggs on it, and they're all clustered together. And you go to the Netflix series, and they're like, no. His mansion's 100 times that size. This table's 80 feet long. There's two rows
Yeah,
of
and
100 eggs.
there's that panning shot. It like goes along the whole row and you get to see each egg individually. So when he says, "I think I'll have a 72 today, Cuthbert," it has just that much more gravity. It's the same line, but there's a lot more behind it.
When the room's that big, you can fill it out with more symbolism and you can speak at a different wavelength to the unconscious mind, and you can make people feel things that they wouldn't be able to feel just because you're limited to a certain amount of real estate on a page, right? Whereas with Netflix, you can say, okay, I see where you're going with this, but let me express it with the full breadth of human ability. So that when George's staff are gone and he's lost his money and he goes to breakfast and Cuthbert estimates the appropriate egg temperature and makes him one egg for his last breakfast, your heart breaks and it confuses you because he is like excessive to the max, right? He's this perfect sort of poster boy for like what goes wrong when you have too much money and not an altruistic heart in some people's eyes, right? And then he loses it all, and you yearn for him because he's actually this really great character that has a lot of great scenes, and you can see that he's a genius. But in the series, you can only conceptualize, you can barely lick the ice cube. And in the backstory in Circle, like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, part of you wants to hate him, but like when you get to like that first story, the first two issues in Circle, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I've read this story before. Yeah, Blue Bolt, he's gay. It's back in the day, what is it, the 50s? Things aren't
30s, 50s,
right. Yeah,
yeah, like
it's like
thirties
the
to eighties,
30s.
30s to now.
Yeah, it's like after the Depression, they're going through this, and like he's gay and he's trying to live with himself and he's living with a triple life. And it's just like, okay, this is a good take on a superhero story, but at the same time, I've read it before. But when the shoe drops, it's like, oh, this wasn't about Blue Bolt at all. This was about the whole character dynamic, about, the whole circle is about the union. It's really, really well done.
Yeah, it's a really interesting testimony to human character traits and natures and what can be done and what must be done and what is happening that has to be accepted and just exposing oneself to the experiences, even in a characteristic form like this. It warms your heart, it makes you cry, it excites you, it keeps you on the tip of your toes, and it's growth, right? Consuming these concepts. I think the superhero story and the moral dilemmas of the Ubermensch and the dichotomy between a perfect mate and a human who wants to be flawed but has this standard to live up to that's an unreachable ideal, and it makes them into these terrible people, and in other cases, great people, but not people at all.
Yeah, and I can't say enough about Mark Millar's writing. Like he's, you can see his influences shine through too. Like he has that hypnotic element from Alan Moore. He's got like that great like, he has the great characters like comparable to Stan Lee. Like they're humans. They're not just, this is the Ubermensch stereotype archetype character. It's, well, this guy's seriously struggling with all of his decisions, and it actually tells the story of the Ubermensch struggling to create his own values. And it really goes into that in the show when he says, like, he creates the code, like, we shall not govern, we shall not kill. That is our code. And, like, it's pretty simple enough, but, in the show, when you get to the point where your son kills a supervillain, ooh, things get hairy.
Yeah. Oh man. So, what was the name of the show that I was just watching a few weeks ago with Omni-Man, the
Invincible.
Viltrumites? Invincible. So that's like we've been doing a couple comic-y digestions of Ubermensch and the father-son relationship and the grandfather-father-son relationship that occurs in Jupiter's Legacy is so fascinating to me and intriguing. As a man with a father, it's something that's very salient and interesting. And gosh, you just can't say anything specific. I highly recommend everybody reads the volumes. There's four of them,
And you
Jupiter
have
Circle
to,
2.
compare it to, the ultimate, father-son myth for me, Star Wars, Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. You doesn't get much more dark than that. If your dad's the Sith Lord, if your dad's a Viltrumite, if your dad's like a, I don't know, like a, an authoritarian, like perfect Ubermensch figure that is impossible to compare yourself to, and you just, there's all that pressure attached to it. But then we can get into like how much they change the character of Brandon from the comic, because if you've watched the series on Netflix, what is a Paragon? Is that his name?
Is
That
it?
is it? I'm not sure, but he's got a superhero
I don't
suit.
remember.
He's got a superhero su suit and an alias, and he's trying to be the perfect superhero. He's trying to be the next utopian, just like his father. He's trying to fill those shoes, and he just can't cut it, He keeps making mistakes. His dad never sees like the effort that he's putting forth. He can't really see it from his kid's perspective because he never really had to, especially not for so long. But in the actual books, the source material, Brandon's just kind of a, he goes his own way. He doesn't really try to do the superhero thing because, the supervillains are all kind of already locked up, The union took care of them all and he's just, I don't really need to prove myself as a superhero, but maybe I'll help some people out by, carrying this boat, seeing if these guys need a lift. And he kind of botches that, almost gets a whole carrier destroyed.
Yeah, it's almost like they did prequel content and story arc because they were like, no, he's
Right.
too dark right now. Let's just rewind that, slow it down, see how he got there. And, in the series, he's portrayed as this sort of like naive, can never do right by his father, is trying to live up to an expectation and an ideal that isn't in line with his own abilities or purpose in life and identity. And trying to shove a square peg into a round hole. And you'd almost see that he's got blind spots and he's going to get screwed up if he doesn't pay close attention to the people that are influencing him in his life. But it's just hinted at, and they're so early in the run compared to the comics that they could still take it anywhere.
Here's what I think they did. I think in the book, what Millar wanted to do was just take, Brandon and his sister Chloe and create the dichotomy there, establish that right off the bat, We don't have to include the father in this setup for, reasons, but they wanted to set up the relationship between Brandon and Chloe more than Brandon and anybody else, because those are really the two main characters of the series. I don't think we're spoiling anything by making that important distinction that
It's it's
Chloe's
obvious,
important.
right? Like, dad's on his way out. Look at that beard. And that's what I said the first time I saw his beard. I was like, ooh, dirty beard. And then I saw Walter and I was like, now that's a clean cut beard. I didn't know the weight of those implications.
There's the clean cut, conservative, upright objectivist. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Maybe. I just got the book on it. I'll have to read a few essays before I can confirm or deny, quite potentially. I'm sure Ayn Rand would be very disappointed in Walter. I think that the people that we probably perceive to be objective have a misguided truth of objectivism that Ayn Rand would disagree with. And so that's why she was gravitating towards Sheldon, because it's much easier to make a man who has greatness into a great objectivist than it is to make a man who has a vision for the world and is fully immersed in his own craft.
That's interesting. I didn't really think of that perspective because I always just thought of Sheldon the utopian as, the altruist. Ayn Rand spoke out plenty against the idea of a utopia. So it seems like the utopian was kind of invented just to irk Ayn Rand a little bit.
That's an interesting argument you make because in Atlas Shrugged, she creates a utopia.
A
First point.
utopia of sorts.
Well,
I think the
the
way
highest
that
ideal of utopia in her mind.
right, but I think Ayn Rand might argue that the way Sheldon goes about it would be the wrong way because he's not doing it for himself. He has zero selfishness at all. He's just put
See, hold on, because here's what I think the exact opposite is what she would think. I think that she would think he's an ignorant, naive, sad little boy clinging to a code to keep himself whole, and that there's room for him to grow into a fully fleshed out, proper objectivist. And that's the problem with Walter, is that when you deal with the notion of objectivism, from what I understand, is that, it's one thing to think that you've got objectivism, but it's another thing to be in line with the ideals of the philosophy of objectivism as set out by Ayn. And that's where I think Walter diverges, is that he appears to be objective, but he's twisted.
Yeah, like he already knows too much kind of thing. Like if he picked up the fountainhead, he'd be like, "Yeah, I know. I figured it out already. I don't."
Yeah, well, it's like Bill Gates doesn't hire computer scientists. He hires people that know math, teaches them how to code, because if they already know how to code, they're already doing it in a way that's different from his way. And I think Walter's like square peg into the round hole of objectivism, and he doesn't know there's a hole that's round, and he doesn't know that the peg he's holding has a shape. He just thinks that it's right, and he's trying to make it happen. Whereas it's like, you need to step back, because Walter's still too an ignorant, sad, naive child. He's just got a different set of ideals, and his say, forget everybody, I know what's right for everybody. So in fact, don't forget everybody, I'm just going to fix everybody for everybody else, and everybody should love me. And it's like, okay, King Cyrus the Great giving back the land to Jews, like literally,
Yeah.
that's what it is.
I think it's like, I always, well, not always, I kind of understood Walter as like the wannabe Ubermensch, like the grab for power, like the constant grab for power, always in his brother's shadow. He always thinks he knows best. So he's just always trying to get that one up on him. He's always trying to, become better than the utopian, because he truly thinks that, brain is mightier than brawn, the pen is mightier than the sword, but he doesn't
I
understand
think
that he needs both. And then when he grabs all the power, he's still all up stuck inside of his head, and then he can really do nothing with it because his philosophy still has holes in it.
that there isn't a lot of toxic masculinity in the characters of Sheldon or Walter, and I'm going to pre-frame what I'm about to say next. When I say what I say next, because I don't think either of them are toxically masculine, and I want anybody listening to understand that I'm not talking about toxic, shitty roles here. But I think Walter is a beta male, right? And Sheldon is an alpha male. And I don't think that they're aware of it, or that beta or alpha males are real, but I do think that the label very much describes a stereotype of what people can understand in the audience as, a beta male. And so what he is he's an accommodating pushover who's really smart and hasn't given himself permission to actually speak with authority and boundaries and set up a reality that works for him, because he's decided to accept beliefs about where his position is in the familial relationship that he has. And so it could just be that his better nature is overcome by his ingrained family traditional belief set, especially because it's the 1920s, right? You want to stick together, especially when daddy's running a steel mill. And the other thing I want to say before you jump in is that I would compare Walter to Dexter from Dexter.
Okay, you need to elaborate a little bit on the Dexter comparison.
He fails a lot more at social interactions than Dexter does, but in the way that Dexter has a code that allows him to be terrible in specific aspects of life, right? He's a high-functioning sociopath that's integrated with society and has a system of ideals. But Dexter got them from a morally sound police officer with questionable decision-making skills, not getting a therapist involved. And Walter pulled them out of the sky. And that's why he fails, because he lacks dogma. Mic drop.
I guess you could say the same thing about the utopian that you just said about Brainwave then, Walter's Brainwave.
I think that's the thing. And that's what makes this even more interesting as a book for the Book Wave podcast, because it again now addresses, which is what do you do when you don't have a pre-existing traditional set of ideals that have been proven over era upon era good, and you have to make your own moral decisions, and like you said, figure out what it is you value and how you're gonna live at peace in the world without Christ, without Allah,
Yeah.
without Buddha, without the Tao. And it looks like in these
Yeah.
two options, we've got make it up and fail forward. And if you have superpowers, it's going to be really catastrophic for everybody else.
Yeah. It's always like really interesting to me to look at the difference in like comic book worlds, the difference between superpowered people and, you know, the regular people, the muggles, you know. Like there's always a strange dichotomy there. Like there's either a celebrity status or they worship them or they hate them or, you know.
And a thread that runs through almost all of them is these superpowered beings have this moral, philosophical, ethical discussion, and one of them inevitably, well, we're not gods, and none of them say, well, do we worship a god?
Yeah,
No,
well,
no one has that conversation. They're like, we're gonna make justice, truth, duty, valor, honor, justice, and they just grab these headlines, put them in some marble, because they all have money, and they go about exercising what they think to be right, and they aren't gods,
Yeah,
and they
well,
don't
this.
worship gods.
Yeah, well, this goes back to the first superhero there ever was, Superman. You know, he wasn't ever a Christian. He wasn't even from this planet. He was an alien that landed, and he had his own values, truth, justice, and the American way. So, when he had nothing to compare himself to, he basically only had that code to rely on too. So, there's quite a few Superman stories that go into the whole, you know, Ubermensch. Oh, look at that. The translation for Ubermensch is Superman. Oh, wow. Talks about Nietzsche in the first episode of Superman the Animated Series. Lois Lane calls him, oh, the perfect Nietzschean archetype, the Superman. Look at that S. That's exactly what it means. So.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of like kick me out of the club. Clearly should have known that coming. But it's like people don't know that. Kids don't know that Superman is discussing Nietzschean philosophy, and that's when I was first exposed to Superman, was when I was young. And it's like these everything that has ever been created and has done well and has stood the test of time has been integrated with all of human achievement. And someone said, look, this philosophy is important. Here's a piece of artwork. Here's an introduction to this philosophy. We'll plant that in your unconscious and it'll just grow. Oh, and it'll take 2 decades.
Yeah.
Could we have gotten here by any other path?
That's always a question worth asking, right? Well, just to continue on objectivist philosophy, let's just bring up my favorite character from the Netflix series, Jack Hobbs. He was the opposite, right? He makes the argument against black and white in the series, right? Like, you see the world in nothing but black and white, but it's nothing but gray. That was one of his lines, right?
Right. And so I read 3 lines out of Ayn Rand's On the Virtue of Selfishness, which is where she lays out the fundamental belief system of objectivism. And chapter 9 was the cult of grayness. And she
Right.
immediately rips into the people that say that, it's not all black and white, it's shades of gray. And it's like, okay, so that's immediately a fallacy, because if it's not black and white, it can't be gray, because that's a mixture of the two.
Yeah. And that reminded me immediately of like one of the most like obscure comic book characters, Mr. A. But Mr. A was the groundwork for jeez, what's his name?
Describe him.
He's like the he's a DC character. He's a detective. He doesn't have a face.
Rorschach.
That's okay. So that's like the third in the evolution. It goes Mr. A, which was the first Steve Ditko character. Then he created the second character, which was a Charlton comic, and then when Alan Moore decided, I want to write The Watchmen and I want to use a bunch of Charlton characters because DC just bought out Charlton Comics. So I want to use guys like Blue Beetle and The Question. That's his name. Jesus. So first, there was Mr. A, created by Steve Ditko. Then Steve Ditko created The Question based off of his original vision. So The Question is like this, like pretty major DC villain, but he's like pure objectivist and he's got like the black and white dichotomy, like that's his whole thing. Everything is black and white. Mr. A even had these like business cards that were half white, half black, and he would like leave those when he would like, clean up the evil, like he only saw black and white, so if he saw some black, he's gonna take care of it. So the question
Gonna
is,
white it out.
yeah, so the question was, the next iteration of that. So Alan Moore said, I want to make a comic with The Question, with Blue Beetle, with, a bunch of these other characters, Captain Atom. And they said, nah, you can't do that. You have to make your own characters. So he's like, all right, I'll make my own characters. So him and Dave Gibbons created Night Owl instead of, the two Blue Beetles that he wanted to use. There was like a Golden Age Blue Beetle and then a newer Blue Beetle. Now there's a third one that everyone loves, but like no one really knew about these characters or cared about them back when he wanted to use them. He just wanted to repurpose them. So instead of Captain Atom, we have Dr. Manhattan, and instead of The Question, we have Rorschach. But it's so closely related to The Question, it might as well be The Question with ink blots on his face. Like they all have the same aesthetic, except Rorschach is the ink blot test, which, that's cool as hell, man. Like that's dope. I love Rorschach.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool character. And like I'd love to get into objectivism more, but we need to read the book.
Yeah, all we've gotten under our belt is Atlas Shrugged, so I guess Fountainhead is next.
Well, I ordered four, and Fountainhead and Philosophy Who Needs It have yet to arrive. And they could have
Gotcha.
arrived any time in the past 4 days to the next 3 weeks. And I got Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, and The Virtue of Selfishness first. And they look so consumable.
Gotcha.
Each chapter is an essay. It's just a compilation of essays.
Yeah. I still can't believe, like, I'm gonna give you guys a little bit of a mild spoiler. When Ayn Rand showed up in this comic, I lost my mind.
I was pretty shocked when Rockefeller asked the utopian if he'd father a child for him.
That was pretty wild too, but you'll have to read the book to see what happens there,
Yeah, the microcosms in a universe that
But yeah, like
dim awareness of, like, book.
it's so fascinating to just like think about the politics of Jupiter's circle and Jupiter's legacy too, because I think it's pretty clear that Mark Millar isn't like a full-fledged Ayn Rand objectivist, because you could really call Jupiter's Legacy a critique of Ayn Rand's work in a way. Like it does kind of serve that purpose, but at the same time, he's literally recommending you read The Fountainhead within the pages of this comic.
Well, and it's a good conversation to be had, you know, like
Yes.
the back and forth between Utopian and Brainwave discussing, oh, so now you know better than the experts. You're an economist all of a sudden. I thought you were a superhero. You can't be a superhero and a politician. Who would beat us if we took over? And, who would beat the tyrant if they took over?
Yeah, And like the whole aspect of the code is like, okay, we do not govern, which means we don't think we're better than everybody else, but it's also we do not kill. But you know, as they go over in the series, like the military, the cops, they're given permission to kill to defend their lives. But the only permission you give to your fellow superheroes is follow the code, which is, you know, if that's not saying you're better than everybody else, you live to a higher standard, you're like something else, you're the Ubermensch. It's still a hard dichotomy to fully get your head around, especially if you're born into that world like Brandon and Chloe. So.
Well, and that's the core of objectivism right there, right? Like, forget what you're trying to do. What has been done, and the empirical data shows that when you live to a code that says, in the same situation and even more unconceivably worse situations, you don't get to do what everyone else has permission to do. When you have that different set of rules, the objective reality is that you are living to a different set of rules. That might not mean that you're better or worse, but it could certainly be inferred at an unconscious level. It could certainly imply a limbic system, lobster brain shift in the way you're seen and the way you see other people in your environment. When you say you don't get to kill, you're basically saying you're going to be the best in the fight every single time, or you're going to die. And we're not in the business of dying.
And yeah, like, say what you want about Superman, but you know, Superman, he's been shown to not be afraid to pull the trigger in some instances. Batman is, you know, historically gone back and forth. You know, he's had eras where he's like, I don't kill. He's had eras where he's carried a gun with him, so same with Captain America. It's, you know.
And imagine being born into the code and having someone who has survived for 70 years and has adhered to the code. And all the while, as you're growing up, other people aren't lasting nearly that long. And it's like everyone's following the code, but a small group of people are living and surviving. And it's like, so what is actually going on? Because it looks like there's some different abilities throughout the hero race. And, you know, at 18 to 30, looking at a gray-haired old man who goes into battle and with the flick of a finger wins all of the fights, you can't even feel like you're a different person from the rest of society because you're now not like that which you are a part of. And it's like, so the objective reality there is like, you're really gonna be screwed up.
Yeah. And you can see like how hard Sheldon has to try and it still does nothing for him. Like he opens
Right.
up Samson's auto shop. Like he still has no idea how to be a human. He doesn't know
Oh.
how to act.
Well, yeah, Sh Sheldon's got like his head in the clouds and his feet went with him. And you gotta watch
Right.
and you gotta read this show. Like the books don't make him seem as much like a prophet as they do in the show, but the amount of followers and disciples he has in the books do kind of still carry with it that weight.
Yeah, well, that was one of the major differences in the series to the show, in or in the series to the comics, because when you're reading Jupiter's Legacy, the first panel is, hey, we all got Sheldon's back. If he says that he saw an island out there in the ocean, he saw an island out there in the ocean, and we're going with him. He's like, all right, you've piqued my interest. Let's go. And then they're on the island. In the series, it's like a huge battle of mental illness, and no one believes him. They all think he's crazy. So, like that's the point I think it's making in the book, that like everybody praises this Sheldon Sampson guy. He can do no wrong. Everybody thinks he's the best, you know, but he's still a little bit questioned in the series.
Well, and it's almost like they say they agree with him, but that almost bears no weight. And the objective reality, as I like to keep returning to, is that, you know, Walter has a different plan, George has a different plan,
Yeah, they
Grace
say.
has a different plan.
Yeah, they say they agree with him, but, you know, actions speak louder than words, that old phrase goes.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know how much more steam I've got in me, but I am going to say it's also a classic story of Cain and Abel.
Right, that's another thing we were going to get into. There's quite a bit of, you know, brotherly love and brotherly rivalry going on there. It's definitely it definitely presents Walter as that, you know, younger, spiteful brother. And you know, it's the same as like Romulus and Remus. Like they're fighting over the world they want to create. Like they both have these different visions for the world. They're both effectively Ubermensch that can work towards creating this, but neither of them realize that they have to work within the scope of regular people in that relationship with Homo sapiens. And you know, if this was a Marvel book, Homo Superior. That's what they call
Well,
the mutants.
that's hilarious. I think Walter's actually the older brother, though, right? Which just adds to the whole spite and everything, because he's getting outshined by his younger brother.
Oh, maybe. I'm
But
not
that's
sure.
really neither here nor there. But with Isaac Asimov's Guide to the Bible, he talks about this whole agriculture winning over nomadicism. And in the Netflix series, there's this one scene where Sheldon's returned from another lucid or fugue state where he's been getting visions and going all over the country looking for answers. And Walter has just lost the company and he's
Yeah,
losing
Reardon
his
Steele.
mind.
That's Reardon Steele. I mean Samson Steele.
Exactly. And he's freaking out and he's pissed off at Sheldon. Sheldon's like, none of this matters. And it's like, if he believed his brother for what he had to say, he could have gotten out of the state that he was in. But you couldn't, he couldn't, he didn't have the bond that would allow him to even give a moment to consider. Like, if my brother is saying none of this matters, maybe he's right. But he doesn't humor that reality. He's got his perception of what he wants to have happen, and he's cold. And he's distant, and George has to work at him to get him involved. And George, oh, the character of George in the Netflix series, I just love his ability to drop truth bombs.
George, like that whole line, like George and Hutch, they're both such good characters. Yeah. You can't really say much about them without all of the spoilers, but like once you get into the reading of this series, you start to realize like which characters the book actually centers around, like even though like the first panels you get of like the modern era are, you know, the main characters, it still kind of circles around until you actually make it to that point.
Yeah. Once the dust settles and you see who's left standing, it becomes a different story and reflection.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited. So we're going to revisit this topic in a few months when Jupiter's Requiem comes out, which will be taking place in the future. So we have the Circle is in the 20s to 60s. And then we've got Legacy, which is in the present time. Requiem is actually going to go out into the future and take that a multi-generational leap potentially again. And
Yeah, well,
that will be interesting.
it'll be like if you've read Jupiter's Legacy, you know the character, you know the main character. It's the next utopian, but that's as far as we can go with that.
And I had a lot of theories. My wife has a couple theories. She hasn't read the comics yet, I don't think. And I didn't see it coming.
But I don't know if I want to wait until the whole thing's out, because it's going to be a 12-issue series. So when it starts and when it ends, it's probably going to be a year. I'm not sure who the artist is that he's working with. If he's working with multiple artists, it might come out quicker. If he's working with Frank Quitely again, I mean, I love him, bless his soul. It'll take 5 years.
I don't think we need to go any deeper than this. What do you think?
I kind of wanted to ask you which book you liked better between Circle and Legacy. First for the story and second for the art. Which artist did you like better? Wilfredo Torres or Frank Quitely?
Why you gotta set me up to fail, man? Which one was which?
Frank Quitely was the original one in Legacy.
Okay. With the weird wrinkly hands
Yeah.
or is, yeah.
A
Yeah,
lot of
so I def
people don't like Frank Quitely. I'm like the only one of my friends that like actually love his style. But like All-Star Superman, he did a little bit of work on Sandman for a bit, so I'm biased. I've looked at his stuff a lot.
The thing, so it's weird, right? Because I watched the series and then I got into the comics and I started reading Legacy and I finished Legacy and then I went to Circle. Or no, I started with Circle and then I went to Legacy and then I went back to Circle. But I'd already seen Legacy, so that's why I went to the prequels, because I was like, I've seen the story, now give me the backstory, because I love backstory. Like, you just have to tell me like one simple quest that has eight characters, and then you can give me 16 seasons, two per character, about what they did 40 years before. Like, literally create a universe, have one guy kill one dragon, having received one staff from one wizard at the recommendation of one innkeeper that his mother lived above 50 years ago, and then give me a story about the staff, give me a story about the inn. Give me a story about the pioneers in the land and the monsters that used to be there, like all day. So I love the story of Circle, but I couldn't love it without Legacy.
Right.
And as far as the artists were concerned, forgive me for saying this, they were close enough for it to be a continuum of art in a universe, and it didn't affect me in any capacity. I was like, oh, there's the characters that I.
Spoken like a true non-reader of comics.
Really threw me off that there wasn't 1,000 more words per page. Other than that, highly recommend.
Yeah, like it's incredible the way like some writers can do that. Like there's barely any writing there, but you can tell that it was so like meticulously engineered. Like it's all in the writing. Like not to say that the art isn't 80% of the book, because it is, but you know, there's a lot you can say about a good writer of comics, and there's, you know, a lot you can say about an underwhelming writer. So he's definitely like a guy that I look up to for sure. So as an aspiring comic book writer myself. But
Fair enough.
I think we've just about covered as much as we can. So if you're new around here, you
Well,
should check us out at our website. We're on YouTube, Anchor, www.bookwave.club is our website. We have a Discord. You can look at that in the description down below. Guest the Bookwave Discord server. You can, you know, talk to us and recommend some books and other comics for us to read. What should be the next comic book we read other than Watchmen? Because I'm already bugging these guys. Did you have anything else to add?
No, just until next time, chin up, eyes forward.
Paint the clouds with sunshine.